It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio, carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My new 15-minute story and opinion shows, John Mack's Radio Rants, may also be accessed by going to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, and clicking on the John Mack Radio Rants tab for an index of shows. Unlike this show, the new show has no regular schedule, but is produced as the spirit moves me, sometimes twice a week and sometimes twice a month. My guest next week on this show is writer, editor, and computer enthusiast Steve Cherry. Tune in and listen. My guest tonight is technology and policy analyst and sometimes entrepreneur, writer, and educator Ross Stapleton Gray. I first met Ross at that time, the CIA analyst, but the name only Ross Stapleton, almost 25 years ago at a panel hosted by the Washington chapter of Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, chaired by Mark Rotenberg. We also soon thereafter on the steering committee of the founding Computer Freedom and Privacy Conferences, which are still running. I had the experience of working with some wonderful people in that role and really enjoying it, but Ross came away with much more from his role, as you'll soon find out. Since then, his career has moved in a number of interesting directions. We'll explore all of this in depth tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Ross. Welcome to the show.
Hey, well, thank you for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in the Detroit burbs. My wife kids me that I'm the side of the family that may have had illegal immigrants since they came over from Canada at some point, I think right after the Civil War. So grew up in about 16 Mile. So if I had my hand visible, I'd point to a part of the palm. And went to school in Birmingham and then went on to college at University of Michigan because it was about an hour away and the best school I could imagine going to.
What did you happen to choose Michigan? Was there any particular program that you had gotten interested in high school?
No, my dad was an alum. Mom went to Wayne State. My uncle went on to become a professor at Michigan State. So, you know, going to the state universities was a big thing. And maybe more importantly, I had no idea what I was going to do. I did not go into the university saying, oh, this is the one I'm going to because it's got a program in X. I was out of high school and on to who knows.
Did you get sucked in the big house football culture there? My guest the last week went to Ohio State, and I asked him the same question about Ohio State.
Well, I was at the right university in terms of that. And certainly, yes, they're the big conference rivals. Not so much. I didn't come out as a rah-rah alum and enjoyed the games, but they're just games as far as I was concerned.
How did you pick the double major and Russian language and literature as well as computer science? That must have been quite unique at that time.
It was a series of happy accidents. I had signed up for German because I had to have a language, and I had not enjoyed my high school Spanish. And or junior high Spanish, I guess, and required 2 years to get out. So I signed up for German and was wandering the halls, Angel Hall, during registration period when I noticed this flyer saying, you know, Russian language, and I thought that was pretty cool. And because Michigan had gone to computerization of registration just a couple of years before, I could sort of waltz down and change it on the fly. And why the double major was because halfway through my time in college, the computer thing sort of struck me out of the blue. I'd never had a computer course until I was a college junior. And suddenly, you know, the skies opened up. I knew what I wanted to do. And the easiest way to graduate in two more years was to do so as a Russian language major and then throw in the computer science as the second. The only way I could get out with sort of the right constellation of credits.
To a friend who you may know, Esther Dyson also studied Russian in college, and she spent time over there, and she's actually done cosmonaut training over there.
No, Esther and I have known each other probably since about 92, and probably via the Computer Science, Computer Freedom and Privacy Program. Esther was one of the folks that came in to visit the CIA along with John Perry Barlow and Vint Cerf and Tony Rutkowski and others. We had the EFF and the Internet Society in to sort of talk about the future of computers and intelligence, et cetera. She and I have known each other for now, what, decades?
That was probably the second conference. That was in Washington. The first, if you remember, was in San Francisco. You spent a semester in Moscow at the time when relations between the U.S. and Russia were less than friendly. What was that like?
This was the Brezhnev years. It was sort of winding. The Cold War was kind of flat at the time. So 82, and the things that I remember most from it are the fact that I left, well, and especially looking back now from perspective of today, I left in February, flew in to Finland, took a train down to Moscow, et cetera. And between then and when I got out to Finland again in the end of May, I made a phone call back to my parents. It was scheduled a day or two in advance. It was paid for in hard currency. That was it. So I was sort of cut loose. I could send lots of letters, but they traveled at the speed of ships at the time. And, and today my inbox is deluged with spam from Novosibirsk. It's been such a marked change. But I was a semester off in the communications equivalent of Siberia and having a great time.
My wife was over there in the mid-90s to do some academic work, and she stayed at the Pruskin Institute, and she said the food was some of the worst that she's ever had. They were very nice to her, but they like to bring her coffee, and then when someone would ask for milk, they'd say, I'd like milk like that, and it'd be day-old stuff. She was also week-old stuff. She was also struck by the fact that the black market folks operated very openly wearing black clothes on the street corners, and no one, including the police, paid any attention to them at all.
Yeah, it's been changed hugely. I was also at Pushkin Institute, and the facility there was built for the 1980 Olympics. So like a lot of Soviet construction at the time, it was brand spanking new and falling down. I've not been back since 88, though, and it's so dramatically changed I don't think I'd recognize it. When I was there were maybe two large neon signs in town, one at the International Hotel and the other like the Aeroflot sign down on Kalininsky Prospect. And I know if I went there now it would look a lot more like New York than certainly what it did then.
I know that you had the summer job at the CIA during that time. What was that like?
Well, I had sort of stumbled out of college again, like stumbling in, with a Russian language and computer science double major and no particular plans. And my the RD of the dorm I was living in had interned with the agency and said, oh, you ought to consider this. And so as of July of that year, I suddenly found myself in a job. This was what was then the Soviet Cybernetics Report. So basically doing a lot of both of my disciplines, sieving through, selecting some translating of Soviet scientific technical literature into English as a part of what the CIA would do to basically, you know, prime the pump for awareness of what was going on in the Soviet bloc. So when I was a grad student, say, I was using the very same product. We were, you know, sieving through that, organizing, analyzing it, and producing an analysis of the Soviet computing industry. So what would be called today open source publication, basically the CIA vacuuming up foreign literature and saying, hey, this needs to be delivered into English for our analysts to look at, be they government or academic.
And then when you had to off to grad school, how did you happen to pick the University of Arizona?
Another fluke. So at the time, there was a research project going on at Arizona, headed by Cy Goodman, had been there. He's now at Georgia Tech, who was studying the Soviet bloc information technologies. I was the third, I guess, doctoral student in that program, the second looking at Soviet industries. The guy that preceded me in that studied Soviet enterprise management systems, and several folks after me studied other areas. I was the guy looking at microelectronics and small computers and did my doctoral work basically on that. You know, here are the industries of the Soviet Union, Soviet bloc. And thankfully wrapping it up with my defense in 88 and turning the paperwork in 89, because when the wall came down in Berlin, all these industries started turning to dust overnight.
While you were there, did you ever get to Tombstone? I did about 40 years ago and fell in love with the place. I haven't been back since, though.
No, I managed to be in Arizona for about 4.5 years and didn't go to Tombstone and didn't go to the Grand Canyon then, at least, and lived the sort of the life of the grad student, so I didn't get particularly tanned. But it was a great place to live, and I really enjoyed sort of the high desert, a lot more livable than one would guess and a lot more life than one would have anticipated.
What was the actual title of your dissertation?
Oh, man, and I actually had to copy and paste it just within the last couple of weeks. But I think it's like small computing of the CMEA community, or CEMA community, basically the acronym that referred to the Soviet bloc, a study of technology policy and management, or management technology. You know, it was an academic title. It was never going to emerge from the stacks.
Now, since you've been at the CIA before and you were back doing the same research, was it a foregone conclusion that you were going back full time?
It was a natural thing to do. I also had a sponsor, more or less, in the National Intelligence Officer for Science and Technology, who shepherded me back. And that, again, was some happy accidents. I came back to the CIA in 1988. My entry on duty, my EOD, would have been the 4th of July, but that's a holiday, so I came back on the 5th. And because the office that was the natural fit for me, Office of Scientific and Weapons Research, was full. They parked me for a year in what was, I imagine still is, the career trainee program. So basically a program that the CIA affords to a subset of the analysts like myself and to all of the people who are going to go off and be case officers, et cetera, to say, you know, here is the whole of the agency, here's what it does, here are rotational assignments to learn more about it. It was a wonderful, again, lucky accident to have gotten that exposure, and I think turned me into a CIA-wide appreciating person, not a guy who was going to go into a cubby and be the IT analyst as a career.
It's interesting. I had the same type of thing 20 years before you, and I had started the Department of Defense in a pilot project they had at the Brooklyn Army Terminal, and I got to walk around for 6 months and to work in different areas and then to decide what I wanted to do and if they liked me to take me there. And I was an English major. I had never known anything about computers, had no interest in computers, but the smartest people that I met there were in the technology area. And I said, I want to do that. And then I said, okay. And then from there to Wall Street, to consulting, to teaching, to writing, all has been a wonderful role, all because I just said, I want to do that. So I was very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
When you got focused after the training program, what did you do? What in your time and duties there, from what you can remember, since it's been a good while ago,
or what they'll let me talk about? And actually, so much of that has been obsoleted by time. I was basically the Soviet bloc computer analyst with a couple of others in complementary or sort of similar areas. So there was the guy looking at Soviet supercomputing as something different from what I was looking at, and that allowed me to gobble up other areas like computer networking. So I was basically the CIA intel analyst trying to anticipate the impact of things like what was going to be the Internet. During the time I was there, I remember BitNet and ERN, the European equivalent to BitNet, expanded into Eastern Europe, which was an interesting little harbinger of networks going everywhere. And then, I'd say the job is kind of a threefold thing, the job of an intel analyst. Some of it is working out what you're going to do over the course of the year. And for an analyst like me in a technology area, it's much less driven by urgent developments. So I'll say, I'm going to look at this and this, the capacity of the industries to support versus import, et cetera, et cetera. And then a third of it is things that come in over the transom as urgent things. The SecDef really needs to know what this really means. And then about a third of it is picking and choosing topics of interest to myself. So I'd have here are the slate of things I need to work on for the yearly plan. Here are the things that have suddenly rushed in the door on fire. And then the last is picking and choosing areas that do seem important and may eventually become long-term production, but sort of my discretion as an analyst to identify.
And because of that discretion, you got to attend the various things to which you and I met. So.
Yeah, that was actually a little more – well, yeah, that was the tail end of my experience as an analyst, and a big part of my experience on what was then called the community management staff. It reported to the director. It worked in the community role as the director of Central Intelligence, the DCI, managing all these agencies. Since then, with the creation of this Director of National Intelligence and the office of the DNI, the ODNI, that function is more or less there. And more when I was in that role, I kind of had license to pick and choose areas of impact on the intelligence community, not just on the things that I as an analyst said, here's the foreign developments of concern, but more here are the concerns and the opportunities that information technology might be affording us, the agencies. This was a time when IntelLink was created, basically, cloning the Internet to have a secure interagency high-security network, and people were weighing in on a lot of international and national policy issues around technology. I was lucky enough not to be involved in anything like, say, the Clipper chip policy decisions or have to say anything about export controls as national policy, because I certainly wasn't a fan of what the government was pushing.
I referred earlier to our mutual time organized in the early computer freedom and privacy conferences that mentioned that you got even more benefit from your participation than I did from mine. Please explain my comment to the audience.
Sure. So I attended the 92 conference and was inspired to present at the 93 conference and participate in the organization. So I ended up giving a talk on intelligence, diplomacy, and warfighting in the information age. A friend who I had only met online or known online since maybe 88, Sarah Gray, was going to speak as well as the online campaign manager of Jerry Brown's 92 presidential campaign, and I attended her talk and and whatnot. And we met for dinner and 6 weeks later got engaged and a year after that got married. So more or less, she and I had met through the physically through the 93 conference. We'd met online years before, but it had never been a romantic sort of a relationship, you know, up until actually meeting.
And hence the name change from Ross Stapleton to Ross Stapleton Gray.
Indeed. I don't know as you wanted to mention this, so I was still at the CIA when we met. She was still working for Jerry Brown, in fact, living in this cottage behind his house in San Francisco. And in parallel, I had been a participant in some other conferences, including the Rural Datafication Conference. So this back when computer networks were starting to transform, say, states, in a state like Michigan, where the conference was in Chicago, but Michigan was a major player in these conferences. Was putting modems in closets in police departments out in the boonies, so people would have local dial-up, and you know, slowly building these statewide networks. And at the Rural Datafication Conference, I met a guy named Rick Gates, who had been doing the Internet Hunt. And for anyone who's as old as we are, there was this Internet Hunt back in the day, before the Googles of the world, before most web search, or before the web, really, where people would be given a challenge to find things on the net. What's the mean temperature in Alaska? And you'd have to use Archie and Gopher and find sites, not necessarily websites, that had this information. And in 93, Rick Gates and I talked about how we were both interested in the idea of what could you find out about people on the net. And I suggested for his next Internet Hunt, he consider just putting my name out there and saying, what can we find out about this guy? Which was interesting. It was written up in Wired magazine. The winning group, I think, wrote up a little analysis called CIA to Wed Jerry Brown, and gave information about how my wife and I had just met and other information. We'd gotten engaged by then in 93. So it was an interesting little experiment in what can one find out about people online. It happened while I was at the CIA. In fact, it thankfully happened as I was transitioning between one office to another. So I could go to the first office I was leaving and say, I know you're really upset maybe about this thing I just did. Don't worry, the other offices let me know that they will take care of it. And I told the receiving office, well, my old office just beat me up. You don't need to do any more. And I think that falling in the administrative cracks was very helpful. But I was rather out as a CIA officer in 93. But I think I'd carried myself as that the whole of the time I was, interacting with folks like yourself and with the Computers, Freedom, and Privacy Conference and whatnot. I've always been pretty announced and would have always wanted that. I was a grad student, traveling Eastern Europe, looking at computers, kicking the tires and all that, and it would have been utterly alien to go back and live in a cubicle in Washington and not touch the outside world.
You left the CIA 20 years ago. Was the decision to leave based on your cross a continent, a relationship, or was there more to it than that?
Well, it was absolutely related to the plans to get married. Well, let's see. We got married before I left, but the deal had been that if she left San Francisco and came east with me, we'd move back. Now, moving back didn't happen until 2001, but by 94, it was clear I ought to move on because the job market for intelligence officers out in California isn't anything like D.C., and so I was looking to move on to another career. I don't recall how I felt at the time about, say, living a life with clearances and all that. I'm delighted not to have clearances. I'm not, delighted not to have to live in that bubble. Then that could have had could have been some of the motivation as well.
It's interesting. I knew many of the participants in the conferences because of my writing for different publications, but I met even more interesting people, like Bruce Sterling at the Washington conference, and then at the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference, and people from all over who have remained friendly. So now, when you and I spoke earlier in this, we mentioned Esther Dyson. I remember being at at the Presidium conference to hers that was owned by Ben Rosen, and Jerry Brownie mentioned earlier was a speaker, and I was standing next to Stuart Alsop, who's been a guest on this show, and Stuart said, "I have a picture of my father and Jerry's father," and I said, "Why don't you go over and have a picture taken with him?" But he was too shy at the time. He's no longer that shy. But I thought, all of these people coming together at these various conferences from so many different ways of getting to the computer, whether it be the privacy people, the technologists, the internet people, and at the CFP, obviously there were representatives of the agencies like the Source and CompuServe who wanted to sell us things, and very early concerned about privacy. I remember Esther raising the question that if you're going to collect information about me, why aren't you paying me for it? And that kind of just went under the rug, you know.
Well, and if that had happened, we'd never have seen Facebook.
Right.
There's a huge part of the economy based on the idea that you will give information for free and joining the community for better or for worse.
In those 20 years, you've been involved in a myriad of activities, including teaching at three universities. So let's begin there. Where did you teach and in what disciplines?
I taught at two universities in the D.C. area before I left, and really fairly early on, overlapping the time I was with CIA, Georgetown and George Washington. The Georgetown one was more fun and more interesting. The George Washington one was basically teaching a database class. The Georgetown one was as a part of their new, at the time, communications, culture, and technology discipline. It was sort of a graduate level. I would say it was kind of like if the Harvard Business School has the Harvard Business Review as its sort of signature publication, CCT would have been Wired Magazine as its guiding journal, and developed a course there on akin to the talk I gave at the CFP conference. So what was the impact of the information age on these disciplines of warfighting, diplomacy, and intelligence? I also taught a continuing education course there, the first thing I did with them, called Issues for the Information Age, which was intended for a more lay audience and just covering the whole waterfront of, okay, technology is coming fast and furious. What will it wreak on society? And using, for example, I got some great promotional videos. AT&T had come out with a campaign, I think around 91, the You Will campaign, where they'd show this minute or two spot and say, you know, can you imagine blah, 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 you will. So you're driving your car at high speed through a toll booth and you're automatically paying from your wallet, et cetera. You're walking up to your house and speaking your name and it lets you in. And, you know, I taught using that and speculating on you walk up to your house and you've got laryngitis, how long do you have to stay outside till the locksmith can show up and put you in? all those, the dystopic side of all of these wonderful technologies coming fast and furious. But in, you know, 91, it's just a fraction of what we're seeing now. There's a great video that College Humor, I think, developed where they're spoofing the what if the show 24 had been made in 1994, I think it was, where Jack Bauer is having to use AOL and dot matrix printers and all of the gear of that era. And it's a great little spoof on how far technology's come.
I'll have to look for it on YouTube. It's interesting because some of the people that were involved in the early CFPs, Mark Rottenberg was at teaching at Georgetown, then at the law school, and he may still be. And Lance Hoffman, who hosted CFP2, was at George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't all the West Coast people.
Oh, I think it's always been fairly heavily East Coast people, and especially as around then was the time that EFF moved from Cambridge down to D.C., and other groups like CDT, Center for Democracy and Technology, were big players. I think there's been more of a sort of a lobbying flavor to it for a while, and that's D.C. Of necessity.
You've also been involved in a number of startups. I remember one that we spoke about years ago that you then discussed with President Damaris College, has been a previous guest on this show. And you also had a number of interesting positions leading up to your present position. Could you fill us in on your work up to where you are now?
Sure. So I left CIA 94 and by January had incorporated a little business to work with foreign embassies in D.C. on the web. And embassy.org launched on May 1st in 1995 and is still clicking along to this day. So Telediplomacy, Inc. was the name then. It's more or less become Stapleton Gray and Associates now as a means to work with the embassy.org site and other things that might arise. I worked for a year and a half at the American Petroleum Institute, which is the lobby or the trade association for the industry, as a telecom and IT policy guy, at a time when there was a lot of change coming to the oil companies. This was the Telecom Act had made them sort of second class citizens to all these cell phone providers in terms of bidding for spectrum. So the oil companies were suddenly becoming customers where they had been owners. There for about a year and a half, and then got involved with a couple of startups. One I was a co-founder of, Sandstorm Enterprises, which was acquired by Nixon, doing technologies to capture packets on networks for analysis, et cetera, kind of used for collection and assessment for security purposes, certainly, but sort of in the generic space of what's happening on my network. I was an advisor to another company in a similar space and worked with a company up in Boston where I think I visited, I never visited their offices, I visited the town once, a company called Skyon, which does traffic simulation, again, network security related stuff. Largely able, though, to work from wherever I happened to live, which was a great, great luxury. In this information age, so I was working for Skyon from Boston, or in Boston from D.C. I worked for a company out in Sunnyvale from Washington even before I moved out here, doing ad hoc bits and pieces, generally towards computer security. Though I'd have to say that there are a lot happier disciplines than computer security, which I find is sort of clouded by this. You sell on fear, uncertainty, and dread. And certainly it's a very, very messy field, and the best you can hope for is technologies that help things get less bad.
You're presently working as both research manager and principal investigator on a Department of Homeland Security-funded cybersecurity research program for an international research institute. What can you tell us about that work?
Yeah, so as of maybe 2005, started working on some areas where DHS has been funding cybersecurity. So I've been several times a PI, a principal investigator, working on cybersecurity grants. The latest project is something called PREDICT, which is a kind of, by title, a protected repository. What it really is more of a sort of a virtual network of resources of use to network security, cybersecurity researchers, where, say, large data sets, several from federal programs, others collected by academics, the folks at UCLA and Cal and UCSD, do a lot of what might be called network tomography, seeing how the Internet behaves, collecting malware, collecting signatures of Internet attacks, et cetera. All this stuff needs a place to live, and the PREDICT program that DHS runs gives the community a resource to come to. So if you go to predict.org, you'll see, here are the data sets curated and managed by these various participants. Sort of giving the grist of research out to the community. So it's a kind of a curation librarian role for computer security related data sets.
Just much to talk about in our mutual fields of interest. Let's start with the Snowden revelations. So I've had Mark Rauch, ex-Department of Justice, head of the Cyber Crime Unit, on the show. And while he said he could agree with some or all of the actual NSA activities, he thought that there should have been and should still be public debate on the activities. But every time the questions are asked, how many terrorist plots did you intercept, how many people have you arrested, the answer always is that's classified. And he doesn't think such a dialogue should be the basis for violating laws in a democracy. What's your take on the issue?
I was astonished by the Snowden revelations. And if you had asked me in 94, you know, walking out the door at the CIA, you know, when would I anticipate mass surveillance of U.S. citizens or the mass collection of metadata, I'd have been floored if you'd suggested it would happen. It really was sort of counter to everything that we were thinking at the time. This was at a time in 94 when absolutely the information age was starting to stress stuff. Like, you know, if the law of the Smith-Mundt Act says you can't propagandize in the United States, what do you say to the USIA putting its stuff on the Internet? Doesn't it, you know, filter back to Kansas and stuff? And given that things move across borders, how can you so readily say, oh, this is foreign, this is domestic, this is a foreign person or not? But I can't imagine at the time I would even have believed that we would see, you know, mass collection of metadata, let alone that this would sort of blip past the public without many complaints. So I'm in the camp of people who not only think that what Snowden revealed is appalling, that the reaction we've had to the revelations has been pretty appalling. I think I'd like to see a lot more fundamental look at what is being done in our name and why, and whether or not it may have some value, are other consequences of it far eclipsing any gains. The two things I would take from the Snowden revelations are one, that much is going on that we really ought to look at, and two, I'd say, you know, a couple hundred people at the NSA ought to have been fired for the fact that this was possible. I'm happy that the information is out, that this is happening so we can debate it. But, you know, everybody from Alexander on down a couple of levels should be answering for the idea that a 30-something contractor could, you know, strike the U.S. with such consequences. If what they're saying about the consequences of his revelations are true, shame on them for letting it happen.
I'm particularly troubled by the fact that after President Bush knowingly disregarded the laws prohibiting this behavior after 9/11, the candidate Obama, the Constitution, the law professor, promised transparency and the rolling back of the post 9/11 excesses. Yet nothing changed under President Obama, and until the revelations. Do you think this is a case of power corruption, or he learned stuff that he didn't know, or do you see it some other way to why it didn't change after he promised it would?
I would have to say I'm absolutely dismayed by his policies on this. You know, it doesn't mean I want to vote for a Republican in the fall, but what it suggests to me is that I think he has turned over a lot to the people running the show, and probably is not at all interested in getting in their way. Not because that side of the government is controlling the executive, but because he's, I don't know if he feels he doesn't have standing to intervene, or it would be worse a net for him to do so, or he may just not particularly care about it. But it is pretty astonishing that someone that is marketed as a constitutional scholar would say, well, these deep constitutional questions are not a matter for discussion right now. I've got to get those terrorists. It's pretty surprising and disappointing. I'd say this, the fact, well, to back up a little, you know, I was an intelligence analyst up till 94. I was gritting my teeth as this march toward war in Iraq was proceeding. And, you know, knowing very well that there was no evidence that could be produced or would have been shown. And so the first disappointment I had with the Obama administration is the previous administration wasn't charged. I really would have liked to have seen an acknowledgement that not only were mistakes made, but they were made willfully. And I think that whole period from Bush's election to the present has really been marked by a might makes right. Whether or not you're the good guys, you don't behave like that, or you shouldn't behave like that. And I'm a bit dismayed, yes, at the executive over the last decade.
The other confusing point about this to me is after the long period of administration officials saying that Snowden had jeopardized lives and relationships, and Secretary of State Kerry calling him a wimp and a coward, the new head of intelligence referred to his revelations as no big deal about a week ago, saying it's controllable. How can it be both?
I don't know. They're, you know, they'll say what suits them at the time, and I think it may just be tap dancing while we refuse to open up the bigger debate of, well, what's appropriate. And let's really understand the potential risks and downsides of proceeding as we have. You know, I don't fear myself that the government's going to knock down my door. I can absolutely understand people that believe that this signals that the government isn't something that's responsive to, you know, the law, to, you know, the popular consent, et cetera.
Moving on. It's another topic of mutual interest. I know that you've written about the Internet of Things. I've watched the great Cisco hype videos showing how this is going to be just wonderful for everything, and we'll check into a hospital and just with our wallet in our pocket, and it will set everything up for us. I've discussed security and privacy issues on it with the ex-Scientific American columnist Paul Wallach, who has built such items for his own home. I've written myself about the rapid movement in this area. What is your work and writing focusing on with IoT?
I started a while back. So I've talked to you in the past about my interest in unique identifiers and product codes and whatnot, and the fact that there's this very robust legacy industry of giving unique identifiers to things, not at the level of, you know, every can of Coke has got an RFID tag on it, but at the level of pretty much things out there in commerce are named and knowable. And there are lots of ventures out there right now that are based on this. And, you know, the whole barcode scanning services industry is of great interest to me, and is very large. And when RFID made its big splash in 2004, really with the standards organizations codifying this electronic product code that should go in RFID tags, a 96-bit space, which is huge, started looking at the potential for, say, RFID and surveillance and RFID and competitive intelligence and situational awareness, what it would mean if all of us are walking around with more and more devices on us, or beacons on us in the form of RFID tags. So I've done some grant proposal work in the past looking at this, everything from security concerns to sort of commercial, you know, where are things moving and who cares about what, the sorts of things you'd sell for market research. Looking back from the perspective now of a decade, I think privacy concerns around RFID are a lot less than one would have anticipated. I think privacy concerns in lots of other areas are exploding. I mean, this was, you know, years before Facebook would appear, and it's amazing what we've all sort of surrendered over in the course of becoming online community. And RFID itself has been fairly disappointing in terms of growth. I think people in 2004 were anticipating that RFID tags would be too cheap to worry about, and we'd have, you know, circuitry printed on every physical object and yada, yada, yada. That hasn't happened, and I'm not particularly expecting that it will anytime soon.
But we forget about these things. I remember when Google first started, when people started knowing that they were scanning emails for directed advertising, people were jumping up and down, and no, you can't do that. And then I remember pointing out that you're not really scanning things I wrote, that you're scanning things that you sent to me, and people say, oh, well, that's all right. And I remember when there was people were jumping up and down about caller ID, which I supported, because I remember living in an apartment and being able to open the peephole and seeing who was at the door and choosing not to open it. But an awful lot of privacy advocates, they were jumping up and down about that. Everyone forgot about that. The RFID, they were concerned with someone would be walking by the lingerie store, and there'd be an announcement that they noted she was wearing the maiden form bra. Why didn't she come in and try ours? And people were concerned about that. And we forget about these things. But I don't know whether it's a lack of intention, of attention, or something new comes up, and it just seems to roll into the background, and just as many of the Facebook privacy things do. And after a while, public loses interest and the companies just go on. What's your take on that?
Well, I would say that the most disconcerting thing is what we've seen with Snowden, that when you can show very clearly that certain implicit trusts were broken or assumed trusts were broken, the public will get over it fast. That's astonishing and disconcerting. I think we are marching towards this transparent society, to use a David Brin's phrase, where so much will be knowable that the defaults are going to be, well, his suggestion for defense in an age of a transparent society is more surveillance, you know, the fact that the watchers can themselves be watched. We can all
Brim wanted us to know who was watching us, though, and be able to watch them, rather than just we find out from an Edward Snowden or another thing that I'm going to talk about in a minute that things are going on that we didn't know about, you know?
Right, and technologies you've not even mentioned, things like computer vision and, say, license plate capture and analysis. We've gone very quickly to the point where we can know an awful lot about everything that's happening around us and share that information with others and pool it, and you know, all the government agencies could filter up into a database to say, well, where are the where is the population going? If we take Brin's route and we all have an ability to do that, and my neighborhood can collaborate on keeping a watch on what the city is doing, say, or what the state is doing, that's great. But if it doesn't turn into action, where, say, the citizen awareness of what the government is doing produces enough of a reaction of shame that it stops, if it's inappropriate, or produces a vote in the ballot box that says, government, you will stop this, and we'll know that you have because we're watching you. Absent that follow-through, it just gets worse. So there needs to be the action in response to what is learned by all of us little people. So the surveillance needs to turn into policy, and I don't know if that's always happening as it should.
Related to that, in addition to issues concerning the Internet of Things, we have companies like Axiom collecting data on all of our purchases, online activities, etc., selling it to the government and to other interested parties. There was a recent New York Times article that you may have seen that detailed how the University of Pittsburgh's hospital insurance service has been purchasing Axiom data on its clients without telling Axiom and making decisions on their insurance. We have cameras all over the place. We have possibility that drones will be collecting information on us. Where's it all going? And do you really think that people will care enough with the economy the way it is, the middle class and everything, to take action on it? Or are we only talking about academic policy groups and people who already care about this trying to do something about it?
I certainly worry that there's not enough popular appreciation of where things are headed. But I'll give a response to this direct question and lead into a second area of similar concern. I think a nice fix to the increasing availability of information is to diffuse it. So it's possible for you to know something, but knowing something doesn't give you any leverage. So, for example, I could get lots of genetic information on individuals, including by going to their relatives and saying, look, you know, here's $10. Will you give me information that will tell me about your brother because, you share many of the same genetic traits? Now, that's very valuable to me if I can be making decisions on whether or not I want to cover the brother. It's worthless if I need to cover the brother because there's a universal health mandate. So I think one way to deal with the issues of privacy is to find areas where you can take them off the table. Universal health coverage would have done that as a nice side effect. I'm astonished that small business interests didn't help drive towards single payer, because it would have made it so much easier for any small entrepreneurs to do what they wanted to do. I think some answers to the privacy question will come out of things like universal health coverage taking health privacy largely off the table. But a related issue, and again, a related case of the public, I think, not appreciating the future impact, is coming with sort of business about robotics. And, there have been a number of speakers lately who have talked about, automation of work. And yes, absolutely, I can imagine automating tons of work away, taking away, human drudgery, et cetera. But we don't have an economy that's based on sharing the gains of that automation. We have an economy based on those that automate can get rich doing automation. So
get one step ahead of me. That was the next thing I was going to, but keep going.
Mm-hmm. So, if it's possible, you look at utopic science fiction or the utopic aspects of some science fiction where, no one has to do drudgery, physical labor, et cetera. Somehow they're all getting paid or at least fed and clothed and housed. And I don't think that's in our model right now. Our model says, well, we got a bunch of jobs paving roads. We got a bunch of jobs, flipping burgers. And the road paving business requires fewer people, and somebody's out there now marketing burger-flipping robots. When we remove that need for human work, I can absolutely see using humans in other roles and in better occupations and, more interesting things to do. But there's no requirement that the people making the profit-flipping burgers and paving roads anymore are going to share that, absent, what we would call spreading wealth or taxing those that got and affording it to those that haven't to some degree. I'm intrigued by this experiment in Switzerland with a national income, basically guaranteeing that everybody gets paid something just for being a Swiss citizen. And I think we may have to look towards that, or at least some way to ensure that there's not a race to the bottom in trying to pay what few humans you actually need. Because so much more is can be done in an automated way.
On the health insurance, I have three or four doctors who I regularly see, my orthopedist and my GP and others, and every doctor I've spoken to, including one who's not in that group, but he's been on the show and is a fairly conservative Republican, all are for single payer systems. And the more conservative of them said that he believes that it should be covered for all through taxation, and everyone should be entitled to health care. Now, I don't know why. I understand the lobbying of the insurance companies and of the pharmaceutical companies, but I don't know why the public, and you mentioned the small businesses and the General Motors, who are paying thousands of dollars per employees that they were adding to the cost of the car, and they were losing out to Toyota. I don't know why that there's not real a groundswell for this universal health care, but I must be missing something.
Part of it might be, remember, all the discussion lately has been how the Affordable Care Act looks an awful lot like the Republican plan for care. I think an awful lot of it may be due to the fact that it was proposed by someone the Republicans hate. So I don't know. We'll have to see what happens in subsequent administrations and when things get really pushed to the breaking point, perhaps.
In relation to your Jay laid a point there. The weekly column that I write, that I'm up to 122 in this series now, is focused on what I call credit disruption, how technology is changing the world around us, often under the radar. Like we walk through the mall, through some mall, and we say, didn't there used to be the film processing store there, or didn't there used to be the music store there, and they're all gone due to iTunes and digital photography and everything else. This seems to be the first business revolution in which the jobs being eliminated through automation, artificial intelligence, online commerce, far outnumbers the good jobs created. And the jobs eliminated seem to be drying up the purchasing power of the middle class. Yet the only people focusing on this seem to be a few MIT academics, Robert Reich, and a few journalists. Kevin Drum, then Mother Jones comes to mind. From listening to you, I'm not overreacting, and I don't see why people don't understand this. That for instance, when we go on to online to pay the gas bill, the people that used to be opening envelopes and they used to be keying in our information, and they used to be adding up the checks to go to the bank, they're not there anymore, and more artificial intelligence is eliminating middle management. They have less people to supervise, and they have less people to pass information up through, because computers know how many people came to work that day. They know how many cars were made. They know how many rejects. They can figure out these averages. They can pass them up to the plant manager, and it just seems to be that we're not focusing now. Some socialists years ago, like Richard Nixon and Milton Friedman, talked about just what you're talking about, a guaranteed annual wage. How can our economy continue if people can't afford to buy iPads or cars or whatever? Do you see more progress than I do? I just don't see the focus on this. I don't see people caring.
I think we're on the same page with that, and I would also mention, Paul Krugman has written on this, and
right.
I think the news of this last week, I think there have been conservative writers saying, look, it starts to break down if you don't follow that Henry Ford-esque dictum of paying the workers to buy your own product. You can't run a consumer economy if you're not pushing enough money into consumers' hands. Now, that raises the whole issue of how much of a consumer economy do we want to have to depend on. It'd be nice if we didn't have a race to growth just because that's the only way to keep the machines running. But this is a great actual segue into a computer security concern related to automation. And I've said a lot of times that we're seeing the right hand, the right tail of the distribution of smart computers, smart software, smart programs overlap the left tail of average humans to the point where we've got bots out there clicking on Google ads or on Twitter, on Facebook. The more that computers can masquerade as humans, the more you devastate certain economies that depend on humans. My newspaper, if I'm running a newspaper, my newspaper depends on readership as a proxy for the idea that my advertisers will find those readers will therefore purchase items, et cetera, et cetera. If I can't trust that 99% of my audience might not be bots, that's a problem. And lots of processes that depend on the idea that one human can only do one thing so fast start to break down when you can replicate human behavior in the form of computer bots. And I think we're absolutely there. We're certainly there in this very rarefied communications of Twitter posts and Facebook posts. There was news a couple of weeks ago of the Turing test and some computer passing itself off as a 13-year-old immigrant. Well, if your communications channel is through Twitter posts, et cetera, it's a lot easier to masquerade as a human. You've only got a very limited keyhole to perceive that behavior and judge it in. So I think another area of significant concern is, you know, what do you do when you can't trust that the thing you're communicating with is a human anymore?
You mentioned the newspaper business, and I may have this figure wrong because it's been 3 or 4 years since I've seen it, but I read that the Craigslist took something like $600,000 a year of advertising out of the newspaper business. And when you have that, and you have like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, they're smaller in size. The Time magazine, might as well forget it because it's got no ads. And I don't know how they can continue if they, you know, if they don't have this advertising, and the advertisers don't trust the public, or if they can do better through Craigslist. I don't know how that model going to continue either.
Right. Well, I know folks who are in the automatic text generation business. So, you know, if you're out on a website like Patch, which AOL owns all these Patch sites, they're more and more generating articles based out of databases. You know, here's the generic article about census tract related data in your area. You know, where are all the single nurses living in the 94706 area code? But you can actually, you know, more and more generate, say, sports reporting from box scores and scour the web for Twitter posts and use those as the germ for writing whole paragraphs about what was happening in that game.
That was written about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. that they were already having computer generated. I was telling some of my journalism students about that. I sure in the right business because there was a number of publications. Boston Gannett, there might have been Kidd that was doing that. That they were looking at the generation from basketball scores because they had the final score, they who scored what, they had the score by period, so they could say Michigan came back from a 20-point deficit at the end of the half to rally and to win the game. So they could make it more interesting than just throwing numbers at you. But
add to that the fact that they can easily go out now and scour public posts to Twitter and elsewhere and use them as talking points. If you've got 10 – this is very similar to how Google does language translation. If enough people say the same thing in two languages, you say, that must be the translation. Well, if enough people are really raving about this play in the third quarter of that game, you could pretty much figure you should highlight that in your auto-generated article. So we've now, you know, put a dozen sports writers at a dozen papers out of business in favor of one bot that's cranking out copy, and it'd be good to have a plan for how that fits into the economy and other people make a living.
You mentioned in the same note to me a lot of concerns with the rapid growth of information technology besides security and privacy. We just talked about one of them. And then you also mentioned the high-speed communication that allowed people in the securities business to do some finagling and the ability to transfer funds and assets all over the world, possibly hiding these from regulation. How's the average person without an IT background to deal with, to even understand these threats and to be outraged about it?
Well, the challenge is to figure out how to make them outraged about what's going on without having to have them understand everything that's going on. So the high-speed trading is a good example of, you know, there are people building custom purpose fiber connections so that they can have a millisecond faster response on trades. That's just an absurd distortion of what we used to know of as a stock market, where the primary purpose really ought to be for me as a public listed company to give a share of my company for capital, for expansion, et cetera, et cetera. You know, functions that take place over weeks and months. Okay, nobody's out there saying, you know, quick, get us $10 million within the next 20 minutes because we need to build a new, you know, pop-up factory somewhere. No, they need investment capital. And yet the stock markets are running this sort of casino operation on top for people doing millisecond trades. And as Michael Lewis was talking about in his book, Flash Boys, I think it's called, the whole idea of basically executing these trades in the tiny window of time when you know they're going to happen by others and you skimming off the profit, that's really anathema to the idea that we need a stable system for investment. And so, you know, maybe policies that said all trades on the stock market will be delayed 1 to 10 minutes in a window because you don't really need to cash out every millisecond would be a fine thing. I don't know how it happens. I'd like to see a popular awareness of the fact that the stock market isn't doing what the stock market really should be doing. And
part of those, part of those changes, though, have been going on for a while. I mean, I came out of a Wall Street background, and we have now the most important thing to companies is not to having a steady growth or selling a lot, but it's meeting the projections that they've made and industries have made, even if they're profitable. And when they don't make them, all of a sudden that you see things like Verizon's announces they're going to lay off 30,000 people or IBM is doing this. And you have to wonder if these 30,000 people, either they didn't need them yesterday, so why do they have them, or if they really needed them, then what are they going to do tomorrow without them? It just seems to be so focused on meeting the expectations of security analysts rather than running your business. I think that's been going on for the last 30 years.
I think it has, and I've heard suggestions for how to address some of it, so making executive compensation, say, sort of slower in being resolved. You don't get paid for bumping the stock up for a couple of quarters in a row. Your pay really depends on a longer, you know, the moving average across multiple quarters, things like that. But, yeah, there's that problem, and it's astonishing to see. Well, you know, we won't even talk about the hugely distorted market now where companies like a Google or Apple have tens of billions of dollars parked over in places like Ireland because of the weird tax mapping of the world, and will lay off people over here but borrow to hire them over there. Yeah, there's a lot of strangeness going on.
An interesting thing that just happened was public pressure. I think it started in either Twitter or Facebook and Walgreens reversing their decision to move out of the country for tax purposes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be nice if there was enough awareness that this percolated up into elections and whatnot, but we'll see how it goes.
I think we both agree that the world has much to gain from the constant development of Internet of Technology. I guess it's very difficult to anticipate and deal with the downsides of such development. We almost always seem to wait until that we find out that there's people with the high speed trading or there's other things going on. Or do you see any way to anticipate the downside of technology, to be looking for the blowback on innovative stuff?
I would say I'm not a half full or half empty guy generally. I think the technologies come and we ought to anticipate and buffer against the problems. And so, for example, you know, the Swiss guaranteed income, which isn't we'll pay everyone to live comfortably, but we'll pay a floor below which no one will fall. That's a great start. And you know, it lets people innovate and create crazy new disruptive things, but ensures that nobody ends up sleeping on the street as a result. And, you know, I think that compromise is well worth making.
But we have a completely dysfunctional federal government now with people not only disagreeing with people, but being hateful to other people. And we don't have the Ronald Reagan sitting around over the drink with Chip O'Neill, or remember Bill Bradley saying that he and Alan Simpson used to play basketball together. We don't have any of this anymore. So how can we, if we can't decide on the debt ceiling in 3 weeks, how can we decide on a guaranteed income or on things like this?
I don't know. I like the idea that at least the concept that say the states are test beds for new ideas, et cetera, and the news of this last week that, you know, all the states with health exchanges, healthcare exchanges, have been doing pretty well in enrolling their citizenry may finally sink into those that haven't. I wish there were more empiricists in government. Maybe we'll migrate that way eventually. I'm a bit optimistic that we will wake up and move along. A little less optimistic on the environment. The news that the methane is percolating up out of the permafrost is really unsettling. But I'm not an environmentalist. I'll support the folks that are working on that.
We've covered a lot of bases in exploring both your interest and career and your opinions on these topics. What else might you like our audience to know about Ross Stapleton Gray?
I'm interested in information technology's impact, good and bad, and would actually really love to get back into the startup game again. If anything along these areas has piqued anyone's interest and they've got a plan to build something new, I'm up to joining. I've got two daughters often now in high school and just finishing up middle school, and they're finally getting to the age where if they don't fly for the nest, we can safely shove them from the nest soon. So it's a great time to launch a couple new careers. I guess that would be my marketing message, that I'm up and looking for interesting things to do.
I was at a function yesterday. It was a sad function. It was a memorial for a friend of mine that passed away, and I happened to be sitting next to a woman who had been an executive with IBM, and she feels that the country has lost its way. We're in a malaise. People aren't starting businesses. They're willing to just let things happen, or the government take care of you. She's obviously rather conservative. And I might agree with 10 to 20% of that. I do think the economic conditions and the closing down almost of the middle class has more to with it, but it's possible that in some areas of the country that we don't have the innovative spirit that Silicon Valley and 128 and then Massachusetts gave us just a few years ago. There just seems to be this, at the top people seem happy because companies are doing very well and the market's doing very well, and we're cutting off extended unemployment benefits for people, and they just don't seem to be all that concerned about that. That scares me.
Yeah, I think I would have to say I've seen lots of interest in innovation and entrepreneurialism, at least among people who are educated enough, have enough background, and maybe enough support. So coming out from a family where mom or dad or both do have jobs. You look at something like Angel.co, which documents startups, and San Francisco, not Silicon Valley. I mean, I'm sure there's tons in Silicon Valley, but just narrowing it to San Francisco is awash in companies trying everything under the sun. I was startled to see the breadth of it. Now, a lot of them, sort of glossing through them, strike me as a little crazed, but there are an awful lot of people out there with optimism and expectations that something really cool will come out of what they're doing. And I also looked at things like Kickstarter and Indiegogo as great examples of people floating ideas that will get funded if and only if enough people think they're that they're great ideas. And lots of stuff is getting done. So I think the creators are out there in abundance. To go, jump way back, I think it would have been a wonderful thing for universal health care, because then a lot of creators would say, hey, honey, you don't have to keep the day job if you really want to follow your dream, because we don't need, your 20th century work model to give us health care. So, if you want to encourage small business growth and entrepreneurialism, go out there and pass universal health care, Congress.
I agree. And thank you very much, Ross. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you.
And in the words of the Met radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for writer Steve Cherry. Until then, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady, Silver, steady. Thank you.